A character, therefore, is no more a human being than the Venus de Milo is a real woman. A character is a work of art, a metaphor for human nature. We relate to characters as if they were real, but they're superior to reality. Their aspects are designed to be clear and knowable, whereas our fellow human beings are often a blur, difficult to understand, if not enigmatic. We know characters better than we know our friends, because a character is eternal and unchanging, while people shift. Just when we think we understand them, we don't. In fact, I know Rick Blaine in Casablanca better than I know myself. Rick is always Rick. I'm a bit iffy. Character design begins with an arrangement of two primary aspects, characterization and true character. Characterization is the sum of all observable qualities, a combination that makes the character unique. Physical appearance coupled with manners, style of speech and gesture, sexuality, age, IQ, occupation, personality, attitudes, values, where he lives, the way he lives. True character waits behind this mask. Despite their characterization, at heart, who is this person? Loyal or disloyal? Honest or a liar? Loving or cruel? Courageous or cowardly? Generous or selfish? Willful or weak? True character can only be expressed through choice in dilemma. How he chooses to act under pressure is who he is. The greater the pressure, the truer and deeper the choice to character. The key to true character is desire. In life, if we feel stifled, the fastest way to get unstuck is to ask, "What do I want?" Listen to the honest answer, then find the will to pursue that desire. Problems are still there, but now we're in motion with a chance of solving them. What's true of life is true of fiction. A character comes to life the moment we glimpse a clear understanding of his or her desire, not only the conscious, but in a complex role, the unconscious desire as well. Behind desire is motivation. Why does your character want what he wants? You have your ideas about motive, but don't be surprised if others see it differently. A friend may feel that parental upbringing shaped your character's desires. Someone else may think it's our materialistic culture. Another may blame the school system. Yet another claim it's in the genes. Still another think he's possessed by the devil. Contemporary attitudes tend to favor mono-explanations for behavior, rather than the complexity of forces that's more likely the case. Do not reduce characters to case studies, for in truth, there are no definitive explanations for anyone's behavior. Generally, the more the writer nails motivation to specific causes, the more he diminishes the character in the audience's mind. Rather, think through to a solid understanding of motive, but at the same time leave some mystery about the whys, room for us to use our life experience to enhance your character in our imagination. In King Lear, for example, Shakespeare cast one of his most complex villains, Edmund. After a scene in which astrological influences, yet another mono-explanation of behavior, are blamed for someone's misfortune, Edmund turns in soliloquy and laughs, "I should have been what I am, had the maideniest star in the firmament twinkled on my bastardy." Edmund does evil for the sheer pleasure of it. Beyond that, what matters? As Aristotle observed, why a man does a thing is of little interest once we see the thing he does. A character is the choices he makes to take the actions he takes. Reasons why dissolve into irrelevancy. The audience comes to understand your character in a variety of ways. What the physical image and setting says a lot. But the audience knows that appearance is not reality, characterization is not true character. Nonetheless, a character's mask is an important clue as to what may be revealed. What other characters say about a character is a hint, but we know that what one person says of another may or may not be true, given the axes the people have to grind, but that it is said and by whom is worth knowing. What a character says about himself may or may not be true. We listen, but then put it in our pocket. Characters with lucid self-knowledge, those reciting self-explanatory dialogue meant to convince us that they are who they say they are not only boring, but phony. The audience knows that people rarely, if ever, understand themselves, and if they do, they're incapable of complete and honest self-explanation. There's always a subtext. If, by chance, what a character says about himself is actually true, we don't know it's true until we witness him make choices under pressure. Self-explanation must be validated or contradicted in action. In Casablanca, when Rick says, "I stick my neck out for no man," we think, well, not yet, Rick, not yet. We know Rick better than he knows himself, for indeed he's wrong. He'll stick his neck out many times. Dimension is the least understood concept in character. When I was an actor, directors would insist on round, three-dimensional characters, and I was all for that. But when I asked them what exactly is a dimension and how do I create one, let alone three, they'd waffle, mumble something about rehearsal, and stroll away. Some years ago, a producer pitched me what he believed to be a three-dimensional character in these terms. Jesse just got out of prison, but while he was in the slammer, he boned up on finance and investment, so he's an expert on stocks, bonds, and securities. He can also break dance. He's got a black belt in karate and plays a mean jazz saxophone. Jesse is as flat as a tabletop, a cluster of traits stuck on a name. Other writers have argued that fine characters are marked by one dominant trait and often cite Macbeth's ambition. Overweening ambition, they claim, makes Macbeth great. Reading this, I concluded that they're dead wrong. If Macbeth were merely ambitious, there'd be no play. He'd simply defeat the English and rule Scotland. What makes Macbeth so brilliantly realized is the contradiction between his ambition on one hand and his guilt on the other. From this profound inner contradiction springs his passion, his complexity, his poetry. Dimension means contradiction. Either within deep character, guilt-ridden ambition, or between characterization and deep character, a charming thief. These contradictions must be consistent. It doesn't add dimension to portray a guy as nice throughout a film, then in one scene have him kick a cat. Consider Hamlet, the most complex character ever written. Hamlet isn't three-dimensional, but 10, 12, virtually uncountably dimensional. He seems spiritual until he's blasphemous. To Ophelia, he's first loving and tender, then callous, even sadistic. He's courageous, then cowardly. At times he's cool and cautious, then impulsive and rash, as when he stabs somebody hiding behind a curtain without knowing who's there. Hamlet is ruthless and compassionate, proud and self-pitying, witty and sad, weary and dynamic, lucid and confused, sane and mad. His is an innocent worldliness, a worldly innocence, a living contradiction of every human quality we could imagine. Dimensions fascinate. Contradictions in nature or behavior rivet the audience's concentration. Therefore, the protagonist must be the most dimensional character in the cast in order to focus empathy on the star role. If not, the center of good decenters. The fictional universe flies apart. The audience loses balance. In essence, the protagonist creates the rest of the cast. All other characters are in a story first and foremost because of the relationship they strike to the protagonist and the way each helps to delineate the dimensions of the protagonist's complex nature. Imagine a cast as a kind of solar system, with the protagonist as the sun, supporting roles as planets around the sun, bit players as satellites around the planets, all held in orbit by the gravitational pull of the star at the center, each pulling at the tides of the other's natures. Consider this hypothetical protagonist. He's amusing and optimistic, then morose and cynical. He's compassionate, then cruel, fearless, then fearful. This three-dimensional role needs a cast around him to delineate his contradictions, characters toward whom he can act and react in different ways at different times and places. These supporting characters must round him out so that his complexity is both consistent and credible. Character A, for example, provokes the protagonist's sadness and cynicism, while character B brings out his witty, hopeful side. Character C inspires his loving and courageous emotions, while character D forces him to cower in fear, then strike out in fury. The creation and design of characters A, B, C, and D is dictated by the needs of the protagonist. They are what they are, principally, to make clear and believable, through action and reaction, the complexity of the central role. Although supporting roles must be scaled back from the protagonist, they too may be complex. Character A could be two-dimensional, outwardly beautiful and loving, inwardly grotesque, as choices under pressure reveal cruel, mutated desires. Even one dimension can create an excellent supporting role. Character B could, like the Terminator, have a single yet fascinating contradiction, machine versus human. If the Terminator were merely a robot or a man from the future, he may not be interesting, but he's both. The machine-human dimension makes him a superb villain. Bit parts should be deliberately flat, but not dull. Give each a freshly observed trait that makes the role worth playing for the moment the actor's on screen, but no more. For example, suppose your protagonist is visiting New York City for the first time, and as she steps out of Kennedy Airport, she can't wait for her first ride with a New York taxi driver. How to write that role? Do you make him a philosophizing eccentric with a baseball cap sideways on his head? I hope not. For the last 6 decades, every time we get in a cab in a New York movie, there he is, the kooky New York cab driver. Perhaps you create the screen's first silent New York cab driver. She tries to start a New York conversation about the Yankees, the Knicks, the mayor's office, but he just straightens his tie and drives on. She slumps back, her first New York disappointment. On the other hand, the cab driver to end all cab drivers, a gravel-voiced but wonderfully obliging oddball who gives her a definitive tutorial in big city survival, how to wear a purse strap across her chest, where to keep her mace can. Then he drives her to the Bronx, charges her $150, and tells her she's in Manhattan. He comes on helpful, turns out to be a thieving rat, a contradiction between characterization and deep character. Now we'll be looking all over the film for this guy because we know that writers don't put dimensions in characters they're not going to use again. If this cabbie doesn't show up at least once more, we'll be very annoyed. Don't cause false anticipation by making bit parts more interesting than necessary. The cast orbits around the star, its protagonist. Supporting roles are inspired by the central character and designed to delineate his or her complex of dimensions. Secondary roles need the protagonist and each other to bring out their dimensions. As tertiary characters have scenes with the protagonist or other principals, they help to reveal dimensions in them as well. Ideally, in every scene, each character brings out qualities that mark the dimensions of the others. All are held in constellation by the weight of the protagonist at the center. Here are 3 tips on writing characters for the screen. First, leave room for the actor. This old Hollywood admonition asks the writer to provide each actor with the maximum opportunity to use his or her creativity, not to overwrite and pepper the page with constant description of behaviors, nuances of gesture, tones of voice. For example, Bob leans on the lectern, crossing one leg over the other, one arm akimbo. He looks out over the heads of the students, arching an eyebrow thoughtfully. Dialogue. Bob. Parentheses. Phlegmatically. Close parentheses. Blah, 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 blah. An actor's reaction to a script saturated with that kind of detail is to toss it in the trash, thinking they don't want an actor, they want a puppet. Or if the actor accepts the role, he'll take a red pencil and scratch all that nonsense off the page. The details are meaningless. An actor wants to know, what do I want? Why do I want it? How do I go about getting it? What stops me when I do? What are the consequences? The actor brings a character to life from the subtext out, desire meeting forces of antagonism. On camera, he'll say and do what the scene requires, but the characterization must be as much or more his work than yours. We must remember that unlike the theater, where we hope our work will be performed in hundreds, if not thousands, of productions here and abroad, now and into the future, on screen, there will only be one production, only one performance of each character fixed on film forever. Writer-actor collaboration begins when the writer stops dreaming of a fictional face and instead imagines the ideal casting. If a writer feels that a particular actress would be his ideal protagonist, and he envisions her while he writes, he'll be constantly reminded of how little superb actors need to create powerful moments and won't write this. Dialogue. Barbara. Parentheses. Offering Jack a cup. Close parentheses. Would you like this cup of coffee, darling? The audience sees it's a cup of coffee. The gesture says, would you like this? The actress is feeling, darling. Sensing that less is more, the actress will turn to her director and say, Larry, do I have to say, would you like this cup of coffee, darling? I mean, I'm offering him the damn cup, right? Could we cut that line? The line is cut. The actress sets the screen on fire, offering a man a cup of coffee. While the screenwriter rages, they're butchering my dialogue. Second, fall in love with all your characters. We often see films with an excellent cast of characters except one, who's dreadful. We wonder why until we realize that the writer hates this character. He's trivializing and insulting this role at every opportunity. And I'll never understand this. How can a writer hate his own character? It's his baby. How can he hate what he gave life? Embrace all your creations, especially the bad people. They deserve love like everybody else. Gail Ann Hurt and John Cameron must have loved their Terminator. Look at the wonderful things they did for him. In a motel room, he repairs a damaged eye with an X-Acto knife. Standing over a sink, he pries his eyeball out of his head, drops it in the water, mops up the blood with a towel, puts on gargoyle sunglasses to hide the hole, then looks up in the mirror and smooths down his tangled hair. The stunned audience thinks, he just pried his eyeball out of his head and he gives a damn what he looks like. He's got vanity. Then a knock at the door. As the Terminator looks up, the camera takes his point of view and we see his computer screen superimposed over the door. On it is a list of responses to someone knocking. Go away. Please come back later. Fuck off. Fuck off, asshole. His cursor goes up and down while he makes his choice and stops at Fuck off, asshole. A robot with a sense of humor. Now the monster's all the more terrifying, for we have no idea what to expect from him and imagine the worst. Only writers who love their characters discover such moments. And a hint about villains. If your character's up to no good, and you place yourself within his being, asking, if I were him in this situation, what would I do? You'd do everything possible to get away with it. Therefore, you would not act like a villain. You would not twist your mustache. An interviewer once remarked to Lee Marvin that he had played villains for 30 years and how awful it must be always playing bad people. Marvin smiled and said, "Me? I don't play bad people. I play people struggling to get through their day, doing the best they can with what life's given them. Others may think they're bad, but no, I never play bad people." And that is why he was so brilliant at playing bad people. Marvin was a craftsman with a sympathetic understanding of human nature. No one thinks they're bad. If you can't love them for that, don't write them. Third, character is self-knowledge. Where do we find our characters? Partly through observation. Writers often carry notepads or pocket tape recorders, and as they watch life's passing show, collect bits and pieces to fill file cabinets with random material. When they're dry, they dip in for ideas to stir the imagination. We observe, but it's a mistake to copy life directly to the page. Few individuals are as clear in their complexity, as well delineated as a character. Instead, like Dr. Frankenstein, we build characters out of parts found. We take the analytical mind of our sister and piece it together with the comic wit of a friend. Add to that the cunning cruelty of a cat and the blind persistence of King Lear. We borrow bits and pieces of humanity, raw chunks of imagination and observation from wherever they're found, assemble them into dimensions of contradiction, then round them into these creatures we call characters. Observation is our source of characterizations, but understanding of deep character is found in another place. The root of all fine character writing is self-knowledge. One of the sad truths of life is that there's only one person in this veil of tears that we ever really know, and that's ourselves. We are essentially and forever alone. Everyone else remains at a distance, changing and unknowable in a definitive final sense. Yet, despite the obvious distinctions of age, sex, background, and culture, despite all the clear differences among people, the truth is we are all far more alike than we are different. We are all human. We all share the same crucial human experiences. Each of us is suffering and enjoying, dreaming and hoping of getting through our days with something of value. As a writer, you can be certain that everyone coming down the street toward you, each in his own way, is having the same fundamental human thoughts and feelings that you are. This is why when you ask yourself, "If I were this character, in these circumstances, what would I do?" the honest answer is always correct. You would do the human thing. Therefore, the more you penetrate the mysteries of your own humanity, the more you come to understand yourself as a human being, the more you are able to understand others. When we survey the parade of characters that has marched out of the imagination of storytellers from Homer to Shakespeare, Dickens, Austen, Hemingway, Williams, Wilder, Bergman, and all other masters, each character fascinating, unique, sublimely human, and so many, many of them, and realize that all were born of a single humanity. It's astounding.